stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Pope Francis is holding Mass today in Havana's historic Revolutionary Square.
Creo en Dios, Padre Todopoderoso.
Hundreds of thousands of Cubans packed the streets and into the square to see the Holy Father on this, the first full day of his visit to the Caribbean island nation. Mass is being held near a huge image of Cuba's revolutionary leader Che Guevara. Also today, the pontiff will meet with Cuban President Raul Castro and may visit Castro's ailing brother and predecessor, 89-year-old Fidel Castro, before later praying with a group of priests and church officials and then speaking to young people. The Pope arrived in Cuba Saturday and was greeted by Raul Castro, who assured Francis in his welcoming remarks that religious freedom is consecrated in Cuba's constitution. Later this week, he will travel to the U.S. for a private meeting with President Obama, and then the Pope addresses a joint session of Congress and the United Nations. Violence has erupted in the hotel in the capital of Burkina Faso, where negotiations are being held to bring an end to a four-day-old military coup. Supporters of the junta stormed the hotel this morning, attacking opponents of the coup. But moments later, those same soldiers jumped to the defense of opposition leaders entering the hotel for talks. The violence comes on the day mediators working to end the political unrest in the West African nation were expected to announce a resolution to the crisis. The government had set elections for a new permanent government for October 11th, but is now suggesting they may have to postpone that. Austria says 11,000 migrants crossed into the country from Hungary in the 24-hour period that ended at midnight Saturday, with Austria's interior ministry saying another 7,000 migrants are expected today at Nickelsdorf crossing east of Vienna. This is VOA News. Scores of Syrian rebels trained by the United States and its coalition partners have left Turkey, entering northern Syria to take on Islamic State insurgents. Meantime, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Syrian President Bashar al-Assad must step down, but the timing of his departure has to be decided through negotiation. Mr. Kerry spoke from London after talks with British counterpart Philip Hammond.
We talked about a number of ideas that we have for how to use this moment where Russia appears to be more committed to doing more against ISIL, to find ways to move towards the political settlement. That's the objective.
Mr. Kerry also urged both Russia and Iran to use their influence in Syria to convince Assad to negotiate his eventual departure in order to end the country's four-year and very bloody civil war.
Restoring the security on our borders has been.
And that is Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull of Australia. Pro-refugee protesters in Sydney this weekend call for the Australian government to do more to assist the Syrian migrants. The certain quarters of the country, however, there remains strong opposition to Middle Eastern asylum seekers. Experts say major policy changes are not likely with the new prime minister after he earlier made this statement about his predecessor's efforts to stop people smugglers from bringing asylum seekers ashore by boat.
Restoring the security on our borders has been an extraordinarily important step, enabling us, for example, to offer the increased and generous arrangements for Syrian refugees last week.
Immigration remains one of Australia's most divisive issues, and the new prime minister, who is progressive, is well aware that tough asylum policies helped conservatives win a decisive election victory in 2013. Greek voters, exhausted by years of economic crisis, are at the polls today to vote for a new government. The election pits the leftist Syriza party against the conservative New Democracy party. The election is the third this year and was triggered when Alexis Tsipras resigned last month after citizens grew upset with him over not resisting European creditor demands of more austerity measures in return for additional bailout funds. Saudi-led coalition airstrikes against Yemen's Shiite Houthi rebels and their allies have killed 29 people, including civilians, in the capital of Sana'a. Those are the sounds of the Saudi coalition and their airstrikes. The coalition includes nine other Arab nations and is supported by the United States. It began fighting the rebels in March, 2 months after the Houthis drove the government from power and took control of the capital city of Sana'a. Very difficult time in that country. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Whichever message that a party has decided to use in its campaign has to be registered and be approved by the National Electoral Commission, which Chadema went and registered wakati mabadiliko ni sasa.
The Tanzanian main opposition party Chadema plans to file a lawsuit against the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi party on Monday.
What we are saying as an association of parents is that it's quite unfortunate that the Kenyan government has closed down schools in the country. But on the other hand, we feel that the move that the government has taken is quite okay because of insecurity that we have in the country.
The Kenya Parent Association wants to be reimbursed for the fees they paid after the government orders all schools closed beginning on Monday.
She says she came here with his spatula to hit coup leader General Gilbert Diendere for him to leave them alone.
And tension in Burkina Faso remains high despite the release of the transitional president detained after last week's coup. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, says it will file on Monday a lawsuit against the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi, or CCM, and its presidential candidate, John Magufuli. This after accusing them of stealing the party's symbols, logo, and manifesto. The opposition party contends the CCM's actions contravene the country's copyrights law, election act, as well as both local and international intellectual property rights. John Malia is Chadema's head of the Legal and Elections Department. He told me that it appears the ruling party aims to confuse prospective voters because of the crowds the opposition party has been attracting ahead of the elections.
Well, first of all, it should be known that the slogans, the signs, and every message in the campaign are required to be registered with the National Electoral Commission, which Chadema did. It registered its signs and registered its messages, its campaign message, including the manifesto that we are selling to the voters. Now, CCM has illegally and unlawfully grabbed our message, our signs, contrary to the provisions of the law. Now, Chadema has decided to take Magufuli, CCM candidates, and CCM as a party to the court on Monday. He has infringed our sign of Movement for Change, M4C. It is a sign that was registered for copyright and patent and trademarks as a mark used for Chadema in his business and politics, but Magufuli has unlawfully infringed that right. And therefore, the party decided to take Magufuli to court, and on Monday we'll be filing a lawsuit against Magufuli for that reason.
Some CCM supporters that I spoke with said they have every right to use the word change for their campaign because Magufuli is not the continuation of the old guard of CCM and that he also represents change. So Chadema does not necessarily have the right to say that nobody can use the word change ahead of the October presidential vote. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, it is not true that Magufuli represents change in CCM. Magufuli comes from the same regime. He is a continuation of the regime. But that's not the case. The case here is whichever message that a party has decided to use in its campaign has to be registered and be approved by the National Electoral Commission, which Chadema went and registered wakati mabadiliko ni sasa, change. That is time for change and a movement for change. All these messages were registered as Chadema's message during this 2015 election. CCM also registered their message. Magufuli is doing this deliberately to confuse the voters because everybody now is supporting Chadema and the changes that Chadema are preaching. Magufuli is trying to steal and confuse the voters by introducing himself as a person who looks like a Chadema candidate. So actually what Magufuli is doing here is in violation of ethical codes and conduct as the parties have agreed to abide within this election. So we are taking him to court not because he has used the word change, no, but because he has infringed the copyright sign of our party, which is legally registered, and it is exclusively used, it should be used by Chadema. Magufuli would only have used it if we approved that, the use of it, but he has not asked for that approval. He has infringed our right, and we're taking to court for that reason.
Now, Mr. John Malia, supporters of the CCM are saying that the opposition Chadema is at its wit's end because the CCM knows how to win election, and because you fear that they will win the election again and maintain power, that is why you are taking this matter to court, and that if you feel confident, then go ahead, campaign, and meet them on the political field on October 25, and they are going to win the election. What is your take?
But my take is that it's obvious that Chadema is winning this election. We are not taking Magufuli to court because we are losing. No, we are taking Magufuli to court to teach him that this is a country that has rule of law, and Magufuli has to abide to the laws of this country. But Chadema victory is obvious. We will win this election by a sense victory. So the very reason that we are taking Magufuli and CCM to court is not about the fear that CCM guys are saying. We are teaching them that this is a country where a presidential candidate should abide to the laws of the country.
How confident are you that you're going to win this case based on the merit of the case you're going to present on Monday in Tanzania's court?
We are very confident. We're very confident we have a strong case to establish, because a Movement for Change logo was registered by using the Trade and Service Mark Act of 2000, and it was fully registered, which is colors and sign and resemblance. So Magufuli has infringed, and it is obvious. So we are comfortable that we have a strong case. Whether we're going to win that case or not, you cannot say it now because it is upon the judges to decide. But we are confident that we have a strong case.
John Malia is the head of the Legal and Elections Department of Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The General Secretary of the Kenyan National Parents Association says the organization will file a suit next week. It wants the court to force the government to reimburse parents for the fees they paid. This after the administration ordered the closure of both public and private schools beginning on Monday. The move follows an ongoing strike by teachers who are demanding a pay raise. General Secretary Musau Ndunda told me the parents support the decision of the government to close the schools. That's because, he says, students could be vulnerable to potential attacks by the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab.
What we are saying as an association of parents is that it's quite unfortunate that the Kenyan government has closed down schools in the country. But on the other hand, we feel that the move that the government has taken is quite okay because of insecurity that we have in the country. When our children, over 12 million children in the country, remain in schools without teachers, then there is that possibility of the Al-Shabaab or another person coming to attack our children. Therefore, as an association of parents of Kenya, we think that the move that the government has taken may not be popular with a lot of people, but also we are minding about the security of these students.
The government said it doesn't have money to pay these teachers. The teachers are saying we are not deterred by the closing of these schools and that we are not returning to the classroom unless we see a pay raise of between 50 to 60% as ruled by a court in Kenya. What are you saying about their demands and the government's stance that it doesn't have the money to pay?
Now, you see, as an organization of parents in Kenya, whatever teachers were given, they were given by the court. And in a matter of where the government should uphold the rule of law, we are saying that since it was a judgment of a court, we, as an organization, let the government comply with what the court decided. And if the government feels that they don't have money, then, of course, they can use the same court to go and appeal and tell the court that as a government, we are unable to raise this kind of money.
However, the teachers are saying that the government appears to find monies for other government entities. However, the government says it doesn't have money to pay teachers. Do you think the teachers' demands are unjustified?
You see, one thing that you must realize is that this issue of teachers' salaries in Kenya is, actually, it's a long, long story. It started way back 20 years ago. And therefore, this accumulation of, it's accumulation of many years of struggle. I think with the government in a political way, I believe even if they cannot be able to give 50 to 60%, then the truth of the matter is that there is need for them to offer whatever they think they can be able to offer. But when they take another stance, then I think at the end of the day, the suffering of the Kenyan children.
So what is the best way forward as parent organization in Kenya? What do you see as the best way forward to address those concerns? Because the calendar year and children will bear the brunt of this impasse between the government and the teachers' organization over pay raise.
Now, as an association, I'm still waiting to meet my our senior executive officials of organization to chart the way forward. But what they're saying is that one of the options that we are trying to take is that we are intending to move to court next week. And the reason why we are moving to court is to ensure that that the money, the fees that the parents paid, and the fees have not been utilized, then there is need for them to be refunded. Because by the government now closing and saying that the calendar of the year has now ended, then of course we have a loss of close around 12 weeks that have not been utilized. And therefore, we will be moving to court to ask the court to compel the government to order schools to refund the fees that parents had already paid.
Masao Ndunda is the General Secretary of the Kenyan National Parents Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. A roadside bomb blast has torn through a military personnel carrier belonging to the African Union mission to Somalia, AMISOM, in Gedo region, injuring two personnel. Colonel Paul Njuguna is the spokesman for AMISOM. In an interview with VOA Somali Service reporter Mohamed Olado Hassan, he denied reports that troops have withdrawn from strategic areas in the region of Lower Shabelle. However, he does say that AMISOM is revising its military strategy.
This morning in Likule, there was an IED that exploded on an AMISOM convoy, just a normal resupply convoy. And because of that explosion, two of our personnel were injured, and one armored personnel carrier was destroyed.
So it was an IED, it was not a direct attack from Al-Shabaab?
No, it was an IED.
If I ask another question, your troops have been pulling back from several key towns in Lower Shabelle region, following a series of attacks by Al-Shabaab. Does this mean Al-Shabaab is getting stronger?
First of all, we have not been pulling back from any place. Like we have said several, we are realigning our forces, because this is part of military strategy. You want to organize your forces in such a way that you will achieve success. It does not make sense for the military to be in certain places where they know that it could amount to losses. So this is part of realignment. We want to make sure that the successes we have achieved over a period of time continue those successes. So this is part of realignment. And the fruits of this realignment will be seen very soon.
Colonel Powell, your critics say that your troops have been vulnerable to Al-Shabaab attacks in terms of their number and the place they are stationed and the firepower they have. And this shows lack of defensive military strategy in the areas you have deployed troops. What's your take on that?
That is part of the propaganda that is being used. Al-Shabaab is not capable of coming up with a large number of people to attack. Their mode of attack is that they want to use as much firepower as possible to be seen like there are so many of them. Al-Shabaab is not capable of coming up with numbers that can overwhelm AMISOM forces. The rest is just part of the propaganda that they use, saying that they have 100, 200 personnel. They are not capable of coming up with those kind of numbers without being noticed.
Finally, the Ugandan president recently said that a number of his troops are missing in Somalia. Are these AMISOM personnel still missing?
Well, I read that in the Japanese media. You would honestly have to talk to the originators of that information. It is very hard for me to comment because that was said in Japan. We have not verified it. I would imagine that it would be easier for you to talk to the source of that information.
But no soldier is missing from AMISOM so far.
I am not aware of that missing, but I saw that reported by the Japanese attributed to the president of Uganda. I would rather you clarify that with them.
Colonel Paul Njuguna is the spokesman for AMISOM. He spoke with VOA Somali Service reporter Mohamed Olad Hassan from the capital, Mogadishu. An activist in Sierra Leone has cautioned against sacrificing education quality for quantity. The country's schools were severely affected by the recent Ebola epidemic. Madupe Taylor Pierce is a board member of the Sierra Leone Investment and Export Promotion Agency and an education activist. He told reporter Douglas Impuga the limited resources should be used prudently.
There is always that risk, and Sierra Leone has not been immune from that risk. And there are various stakeholders within that profile that ideally should be invited to the table to have that kind of vigorous discussion as to what you do and where you concentrate, because we live in a world of limited resources, and as much as we would love to be able to do everything, which is get every kid into school and give them, every kid, a world-class education, when you are in less developed countries like Sierra Leone, you are limited by resources, both financial and capacity, so you have to make sometimes some tough choices. Part of the challenge that has occurred is the fact that, unfortunately, not all sort of stakeholders have been represented, especially in this recent past at the Board of Education level, to make sure that the interests of all sides are taken into account. So right now, we've leaned much more towards quantity and just getting more kids into the system as opposed to the quality, which is making sure that once they're in the education system, they receive a quality education. That has certainly affected our, you know, examination results and the quality, and it is going to continue to affect that going forward.
In many developing countries, especially in Africa, there's a tendency for girls to have a lower graduation rate than boys, and maybe due to other social or cultural aspects, the girl child being left behind. How is the situation like in Sierra Leone?
Well, unfortunately, Sierra Leone is no different from many of the African countries when it comes to the issues of the girl child being left behind. And in this area, you know, I must give a lot of credit to the donor community, because they have made this a priority, you know, in terms of both their funding and technical assistance that has been given. Unfortunately, I mean, it's an uphill road to climb, because the fact is that the girl child being left behind is not just, it's almost less due to any particular policy, but more due to cultural constraints, especially within the less educated populace of Sierra Leone.
Madupe Taylor Pierce is a board member of the Sierra Leone Investment and Export Promotion Agency. He spoke with reporter Douglas Impuga from Washington. In West Africa, tensions in Burkina Faso remain high. This despite the release from custody of the former transition president and other ministers Friday. They had been held hostage by soldiers from the Presidential Guard, who seized power earlier in the week. Across the country, groups of protesters are putting up roadblocks to show their discontent over the coup. For VOA, Emily Iob reports from Burkina Faso.
On state television, a member of the National Council for Democracy, the military group behind the coup, announced the release of most of the officials they had been holding since Wednesday.
En signe d'apaisement et d'intérêt général, le CND a pris les mesures suivantes.
He says, in order to appease the situation and work for the general interest, the CND took the decision to release the ministers as well as Micha Kafando, former transition president. The fate of Prime Minister Isaac Zida, a former member of the military body behind the coup, remains unknown. The CND also announced the reopening of all state borders after a 24-hour lockdown. When the news came, long lines of people formed with the hope to get through at one of the land border posts with Ivory Coast, and dozens of trucks and buses could be seen parked along the road leading to the border. But these announcements didn't stop the protests that had been going since the coup. Roadblocks made of branches and tires were set up at various points on the road from the border to Burkina's second biggest city, Bobo-Dioulasso. In town, citizens protested in front of a military camp to try get the soldiers to join the movement. Protester Clarisse Koura explained why she is here. She says she came here with this spatula to hit coup leader General Gilbert Diendéré, for him to leave them alone. She says they do not want him in power. A few hundred people gathered at one of the main squares. The crowd could be heard singing Our Homeland or Death, a motto from Burkina's revolutionary figure and former president, Thomas Sankara. In capital city Ouagadougou, clashes were also reported between anti-coup protesters and soldiers. A delegation from Economic Community of West African State, ECOWAS, arrived in Burkina and met with General Diendéré, the leader of the CND, to try to mediate the crisis. The CND is asking for inclusive elections, which would allow former member of President Blaise Compaoré's government to run. Compaoré has been president of Burkina for 27 years, before being ousted from power last year, after he tried to change the constitution in order to seek another term in office. Emily Up from UN News, Bobo-Dioulasso, Burkina Faso.
The number of Ebola cases in West Africa continues to drop sharply, raising the hope that efforts to fight the epidemic are succeeding. Liberia was recently declared Ebola-free for the second time. VOA's Jackson Mvunganyi has this report.
Liberia was first declared Ebola-free in May, but a new case in the month of June reversed that status as authorities continue to monitor the situation. Talbot Nyeswa is the Deputy Minister of Health in Liberia. He's also head of Liberia's Incident Management System, in charge of coordinating efforts to fight the deadly virus. He says that gaining the Ebola-free status is attributed to collective efforts between the government, people, and the international community.
This time we've gained knowledge, experience, resiliency as a people, and we were able to turn the tide very quickly with the two cases that occurred, the March 20th case and the June 29th case, 2015. We're able to mobilize our team, the community that got affected, the Nidowen community in Magibi County and the Magibi people.
As of early September this year, two incubation periods have passed and no new cases have occurred in Liberia. Nyeswa says that the health system in Liberia continues to take precautions to prevent transmission in the country.
A collective effort, the international support, running the ETUs, the laboratory system, the community support, the psychosocial epidemiology team, contact tracers, barrier teams, community-based initiative groups.
Figures show that almost 5,000 Liberians have died from Ebola since the outbreak began in mid-2014. A recent conference convened at the UN raised over $3 billion to help in the Ebola recovery efforts for Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Nyeswa says that the turning point in the efforts against Ebola came after the three West African countries realized that they had to collaborate in the fight.
Even our colleagues in Guinea and Sierra Leone, we work together very closely. Remember, at a certain point, we were approaching the crisis as country crisis, individual country dealing with this situation. But at some time, our leaders came together and took head on this as a regional crisis, as a Mano River Union crisis. And with this, we worked together as a team. We knew very well that one country being Ebola-free was not enough to save the region.
WHO says that while it is confident that Liberia has interrupted transmission, it is worried that outbreaks persist in neighboring countries of Guinea and Sierra Leone. It says that this situation creates a high risk that infected people may cross into Liberia over the region's porous borders. There were five confirmed cases of Ebola reported in the week ending 13th September, and they were all in Sierra Leone. Meanwhile, Guinea recorded its first Ebola-free week in over 12 months. For Voice of America, I'm Jackson Mvunganyi.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Well, it's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, September 20th. Senegal has won the men's football gold at the 11th edition of the four-yearly All-Africa Games, which rounded off today, Sunday, in Brazzaville, the Congolese capital. The Senegalese beat Burkina Faso 1-0 to win the gold on Friday. Moussa Seydi scored the goal 84 seconds into the game. It was the first gold for Senegal in the history of the men's football event at the Games. On Thursday, Nigeria, which had been favored to win the gold in the under-23 football event, could only get the bronze after beating host Congo 5-3 on penalties. Both teams played goalless at regulation time. It was the third bronze for Nigeria in men's football since the competition started, as the country previously finished third in 1991 and 1995. With Senegal winning the gold, Burkina Faso the silver, and Nigeria the bronze. This is the first time in the history of the games that the gold, silver, and bronze football medals will be won by teams from the same region. Senegal, Burkina Faso, and Nigeria are all in West Africa. In women's football event at the games, Ghana clinched the gold medal, also for the first time since the game started 50 years ago. The Ghanaians beat Cameroon 1-0 in the final on Friday. The victory was a sweet revenge for the Black Queens, who lost by a similar margin to their Cameroonian counterparts at the final of the 2011 edition of the Games in Maputo, Mozambique. Ivory Coast won the women's football bronze after defeating Nigeria 2-1 in the third place match on Thursday. Turning to athletics, African runners won the men's and women's titles at the 35th edition of the Beijing International Marathon in the Chinese capital today, Sunday. The men's title was won by Kenyan veteran Mariko Kiplagat Kipchumba, ending a three-year Ethiopian winning streak. Kipchumba, who is 41, stayed at the leading group from the start of the race and clocked 2 hours and 11 minutes to finish first. The time is 5 minutes shy of his personal best of 2 hours, 6 minutes and 5 seconds. Pre-race favorite Berhanu Shifarawa of Ethiopia came home second in 2 hours, 11 minutes and 37 seconds. Zimbabwe's Wirima Ejuwau, the 15th place finisher at the 2012 Olympics, finished third in 2 hours, 14 minutes and 25 seconds. The women's race turned out to be a straight fight between two Ethiopian runners, Abebe Jafewok and Bethlehem Moges. The 24-year-old Moges won in 2 hours, 27 minutes and 31 seconds. Afewok, who is also 24, was second in 2 hours, 29 minutes and 12 seconds. Staying with athletics, African runners will headline a world-class men's field at the 2015 New York City Marathon. The IAAF Gold Label Road Race will hold on November 1st. Defending champion Wilson Kipsang of Kenya and 5 other African runners occupied the top 6 places on the list of the elite men who are due to run in New York. Others include 2014 runner-up Delisa Desisa of Ethiopia, who won this year's Boston Marathon, and 2014 third-place finisher Gabriel Gebremariam, also of Ethiopia. Also on the list are world cross-country and half-marathon champion Jeffrey Kinworo of Kenya, Yemani Segai of Ethiopia, and Stanley Biwott of Kenya. Back to football news. Sepp Blatter has tried to rally the troops at the headquarters of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, after the suspension of his top deputy. FIFA Secretary General Jerome Volker was suspended on Thursday night over accusations involving black market World Cup tickets. Blatter sent an email to more than 400 staffers after the suspension. Please be assured that FIFA remains confident of its ability to recover from the present difficult situation and to restore its reputation for the good of the game, Blatter wrote in the email. I urge you all to continue your hard work to develop, promote, and celebrate the game with love, said Blatter. Blatter is due to step down as FIFA president on February 26th after 18 years on the job, under pressure from the investigations of bribery and money laundering. FIFA has directed its ethics committee to investigate the latest allegations made against the Secretary General by ticket agent Benny Allen. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sport Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Super diva, turn over 10, Jambore. Super mama,
be out of your super idiot. Oh, incredible.
I go make you feel alright. I go love you till you go be like coffee. It's alright. We go jambori. We go dance in shokori. You dey feel my melody. Oh yeah, make we go limbobo. Eh. Oh yeah, jambori. Jambori. You dey feel my melody. Oh yeah, make we go limbobo. Eh.
Oh my lover.
Jambori. Oh my lover, hey my lover, oh my lover, in a waka misi. My lover, got to walk on Miranda, oh, fashion Nikita, ha, say. No worry baby, I give to you everything you need. You know go suffer, we go jolly. I get you plenty, plenty money. From Kampala, take you to Lagos, anywhere you want go. Eddie Kenzo, KC, flexing and shopping. Baby, come on, let's go.
Holy, pa, shake it. Roll in my baby, move it. Holy, pa, shake it. Roll in my baby, move it.
Hey, my lady, yo. Taba some pensi, oh, no, wanga su sekal. Maswaka swaka ngabiya sekale. Oh no wanga su sekale. Hapana na Kim Kardashian.
Oh my lover.
Jambore.
Ah.
Hey my lover.
Jambore.
Oh my lover.
Jambore.
Hey my lover. Oh my lover.
Jambore.
Ina waka misi. Hey my lady.
Jambore.
Taba sampesu.
Bad man people over me, one of so people over me, get out the people all over me. Some bad man came from everywhere. Eddie comes on Mori Vapu, but the Jacob to rock a Mori Vapu. Come on,
don't go.
City now would day, Samani Napolekana.
Don't go.
City now would day, Sigas have said of your color.
Don't go.
City now would day, Samani Napolekana.
Don't go.
Sitting up with them, because I've been sitting up here for a
while.
kuyomba sitera ate sitera kunyika nyika oh era sitera na ya macho ba wano babi oh fute bigambo bifuse bigambo tuna jepite yo kambyo lukambo lufuse lukambo tuna jepite yo eh uliwene nyenyonyo lulutalo embere ulaya lutalo Funa ya kaoko lutalo Sajari ya bende nganda bie Kubanga mulino buvasi mungalu Mamaso kabalina mungalu Katonda ya kabomu kisa Feba biriva tukirisa Mirabu ya galambe kubiange Sensire kukwe Nida baba Toko ya Sirina bute Simanyina kulekana Toko ya Sirina bute Nasika za visera vya kola Toko ya Sirina bute Manina kulekana Toko ya Sirina bude Sika za visera vya kola Luka tinja jinga Muka makulaba I will never judge you Kuba I'm not bad to you Nuse pulira binji nesirika Atekwe vyo yogera Osasula maulire gafume Bakuba nesirika Sirina chakono ni wabigambo vyo Na mtima mume Feka tukole vya fayo mocha temari wo Abaka vimu mulembe kunu ateno kulita wo Chakola mpaka lweni va museno na yesi kwa Nabirira mwana wange, nabirira vantu wange Kolelela ula mbange, ninonyeza senti kwe yogera Kukoya, siri na bute, zimanyi na kulekana Kukoya, siri na bute
Eddie Kenzo, I'm a superstar.
Me, I love them. I like the way them they jump around. Me, I like the way them they twist it down. Me, I like the way girls they wind me down. I say me, I love them. Me, I love them. Love me, love me. Need me, need me. All my ladies, everybody, they want me. The sexy body girls, they with me. She say, love me, she love me. She want me, yeah, she want me. All my pum pum, everybody love me. Sexy body girls, they with me.
That was our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Here we go again. Once again, an African country has been seized by the military in an unnecessary coup d'etat. Last week, the military took over the government of Burkina Faso, a country that was moving in democratic steps for an election on 11th of October. But suddenly the military moved in, detained the president, the prime minister, and other officials, and then announced it had taken over the government. It argued that it had done so because the transitional government was discriminating against some political forces. But perhaps they were concerned that attempts were being made to disband the Presidential Guard, a very powerful military unit. As should have been expected, the people and civil society groups came out to protest the takeover, as they have done when their former president, Kampore, tried to extend his long rule by tampering with the constitution. And regrettably, as should have been also expected, many of them have been killed. Now, even though the junta may have been able to maintain some semblance of order in Ouagadougou, the capital, they have lost control over the rest of the country, where people are out in the streets demonstrating against them. The African Union has already taken steps to expel Burkina Faso and to warn that on Tuesday, if the military had not returned power back to the transitional government, targeted sanctions should be considered. But it should also be noted that the example of Sierra Leone should be borne in mind. In 1997, at the eve of the summit meeting of the African Organization Unity in Harare, the AFRC took the government over of President Kabah. It was that summit in Harare that for the first time in Africa decided military coup d'etat are unacceptable and refused to accept the coup in Sierra Leone. It mandated ECOWAS to restore constitutional rule. And by combination of people power led by the students in Sierra Leone, the Kamajos who kept harassing the military, and ECOMOG of ECOWAS, combined with diplomatic pressure, whereby not a single government, not even Charles Taylor, recognized the AFRC government, it was possible to restore the government of President Kabah in 1998. So in the case of Burkina Faso, even though the African Union has suspended the government or the country, it should maintain the representatives of the transitional government in Addis Ababa and deal with them. Equally, the United Nations, United Kingdom, France, and United States have all condemned the coup in Burkina Faso. But they should maintain their representatives at the UN, giving them legitimacy and recognition, and not the military junta. This does not mean that one should not dialogue with the military in the restoration of constitutional rule. And in this regard, the meeting of the presidents of Benin and Senegal in Ouagadougou should continue. Perhaps in agreeing to return to the barracks, some accommodation could be made in their concern that not all political forces are being allowed to participate in the political process. What I'm suggesting is that the pressure on the military should be so severe that they will come to recognize that the political life of Burkina Faso should be decided by the ballot and not by the bullet. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline African team, managing editor William Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Adeyemi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov. We say thanks for joining us, and remember, as the elders say, when the crocodile smiles, be extra careful. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since the separation of South Sudan in July 2011, the Republic of Sudan's economy has spiraled downward. The loss of 75% of its oil revenue, along with ongoing conflict in parts of the country, particularly the Darfur, Blue Nile, and Kordofan regions, has caused massive displacement of the population and, as a result, a disruption of food production. This means that large segments of the population are going to bed hungry every night. Today, some 4 million Sudanese people are in desperate need of food assistance. In a bid to head off a potential food insecurity in Sudan, the United Nations World Food Program, or WFP, aims to deliver food and nutrition to around 2.3 million people. Another 715,000 will receive food in payment for helping to create or restore community infrastructure or to help increase the incomes of their fellow citizens by providing support and skills. The United States is assisting the WFP wherever possible. Through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the United States government is contributing $86 million in food assistance to the WFP to be used for the benefit of those in need of assistance in Sudan's Darfur, North Kordofan, and West Kordofan states. Of the $86 million donated, $75 million will purchase about 69,000 metric tons of U.S. food. The remaining $11 million will come in the form of food vouchers, allowing voucher recipients to make their own choices from a variety of food items. This funding will also include enough cash for WFP to purchase more than 103 metric tons of locally produced specialized nutrition products to prevent and treat malnutrition in children under age 5. This most recent contribution brings the total U.S. government food assistance for Sudan to $170 million this year. The American people, this time working through WFP, remain committed to helping vulnerable Sudanese, said U.S. Chargé d'Affaires Ambassador Jerry Lanier. We hope that current conflict ceases soon, so there will no longer be need for food assistance in Sudan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.